Well, hello and welcome to what is the 121st episode of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Al Coates, and him,
Scott Casson Rennie.
Well, Scott, look where you are. You're in your little naughty corner.
I know, I am. I feel like it as well, honestly. I'm sat on the floor on a cushion. I was on my knees and then I started to get pins and needles in my feet. So I've had sat on my bum on a cushion in a room full of everything apart from what it should be full of. But anyway, yes.
You've had a really exciting week, haven't you?
I have. I've had an exciting couple of weeks, actually.
Mm.
Yeah.
Come on then, share with the group. Can you share?
Well, I'm not... When is this going out? Just out of interest.
Friday.
Right, okay.
No, so Saturday.
I can't say who, but I can say that I am going back to work. I'm going to work, yay! After nearly 2 years of... not working. attempting to go freelance during COVID was not a smart idea, but there you go. I'm going to work for a very prestigious, in my eyes, voluntary adoption agency who I've wanted to work for quite a while.
Well done.
Years, actually. All kind of done and dusted yesterday, but I can't say, I don't want to say who until I've got my start date.
No.
Stuff. Yes, I did. Shush, don't go there.
Oh, so that, right, I'll be getting a call, will I? So, like a referee?
You will get a call, yeah. So be nice. Oh,
I've got some things to tell them about your, some of your habits, shall we say.
Yes. So, and that fits really well, actually, because it's not like proper full time. It's like 25 hours a week, which is fantastic and suits me really nicely at the minute. Because I also was appointed a director, voluntary director of a suicide prevention charity here in Ireland week four last as well.
How did that happen?
I got bored one day. I'd had a glass of wine. I just thought, oh, look at that. I'm going to be responsible for public relations and representative of the hub that we're opening in the town that I live. So really worthwhile cause. It's in the process of... becoming a charity, as you know my own personal experience of family members who've sadly taken their own lives and mental health and all that sort of stuff, and of course in adoption as well, because you know there's high prevalence of mental health issues and suicide rate in adoption is 1 in 4 of adoptees, so it feels really personal, feels really relevant, and so it fit really well with the 25-hour thing, so I've got a bit of time to dedicate to that
and the podcast, of course. Finished
my little course I was doing, and I know everything about everything. So, you know, 6 weeks of doing a course, and you go, well, I know everything now. So, I don't. I really don't.
You've been very busy, very, very busy. It makes my life look mundane and average.
But also, it just shows like patience is a virtue sometimes, and fate is a big thing as well. You know, with yourself, I was pretty down last year about not working and all that sort of stuff. Doing lots of stuff, but not actually paid stuff, and so it's really coming up. So yeah, so I'm delighted. Excellent. I am. Delighted.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fine line between patience and apathy, isn't there? But we can reflect on that maybe later. You're giving me daggers.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of podcast news, really. There's not a lot of adoption news. Adoption seems to go on quiet. It's all the hot weather. Maybe everyone's got in. So maybe we should crack on with this. This episode is. It's kind of a partner to the one we did a few weeks ago, isn't it? Where we talked about allegations and kind of concerns and safeguarding and working with children's social care, sort of safeguarding teams in relation to adoption. And that kind of sprung out a conversation I had with Harvey Gallagher from the National Association of Fostering Providers. And I said, Harvey, would you come on? And he said, actually, I don't know anything really about this. So you need to get someone who really knows what they're doing. So I'm really pleased to introduce our guest for this podcast, which is Catherine Lockett, who is an associate at the National Association of Fostering Providers. Hello, Catherine.
Hi. Nice to be here. Thanks.
Well, you sat there very patiently while we were prattling.
Very well done, actually. Normally, we have giggles, chuckles, and people trying to say stuff as well. And you're a pro at this.
So best behaviour. Yeah.
Excellent. Catherine, could you introduce a little bit about yourselves and then tell us a little bit about the work you've been doing in relation to allegations and foster care?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been in sort of social care now for around 37 years. So I'd started as, well, started a long time ago as a mental health nurse and then moved into social work where I've held positions really within local authority, within the independent sector. So I've sort of had the experience of things from both sides. So I've worked in CAMHS and safeguarding and leaving care services and then ended up in fostering where I was the registered manager within a local authority. And then actually had the pleasure of having my own fostering agency before I became the regional director of a much larger organisation. So, yeah, I've held positions within that that's like ADM, so the decision maker and the director and the been on panel, I've been a panel chair. So I've done all positions, really. And last year I went to work as an associate with National Association of Fostering Providers with Harvey. So that's been an absolute pleasure where I'm really enjoying hearing about people's difficulties and good practice and, you know, and all that's going on in the fostering world and seeing how we can support people that come into issues or sharing the messages, really.
I mean, that's fantastic. And I have to say that after we've stopped recording, could you hang around and talk about our underachieving? Because we're starting to feel like we've not really done very much, have we, Scott? The pair of us. Oh, you've just done, I mean, Catherine, you've packed in so much stuff. I'm just like kind of thinking, yeah. Oh, and I've got like, my CV's like, I have to stretch it out to three lines on a piece of paper.
Yeah, well, I did think about, you know, retiring last year. I did leaving during COVID to set up as a consultant and trainer and took the plunge. So, yeah, I've actually enjoyed as well the running various courses, which I've been doing now for some time and covering subjects like allegations, complaints, Ofsted, do mock inspections and so on for myself. So it's been quite a good year. I've had quite a lot of people come in. It's just a pleasure to hear people's experiences. Yeah.
And wow. It must be like, you must just get it. Like when, you know, these providers and foster cares and stuff, you know, you must have heard this stuff many times before, but you must just relate to it in terms of, you know, the services that you've provided and being a director and panel member, you know, all that sort of stuff.
That must be nice
for other people here as well.
Yeah, I think I've got, you know, I think it's always helpful when you're being a consultant or a trainer to be able to offer real life stories and examples because that's what people relate to and, you know, obviously seen and heard a lot of things over many, many years and some things you want to forget and other things you can't forget, and, you know, and it's wonderful to share good practice because there's a new enthusiastic group of people coming into social work that you know, are our future, and it's important we make sure that they're looked after and get it right.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about allegations, I mean, do we have a rough idea of how frequent allegations? I know that the GMB did some research, but how often are people getting allegations against them?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I think for probably agencies, they're probably thinking, you know, everyone feels like it's one too many, and you know, having to deal with it. And we at NAFP did some. Some good practice guidance around drifting allegations recently, and one of the things that I looked at was the amount of allegations, and just in during 2019 and 20 there was 2,495 allegations of abuse made against foster carers, and 63% of those was made by children. What's interesting though is that it's been consistent around that number for the year before that and the year before that. So it's actually where I was thinking, it's felt like it's been growing. It's actually been, you know, pretty consistent in its numbers. And the majority of, well, 56% of that was is physical abuse, that are the allegations, less so around, sexual abuse and so on. But interestingly as well, I was looking at in that same year, that period, there was 990 reported incidents of restraints, and I think that, that felt quite shocking, really. And I mean, I don't know what people's definition of restraints are, and neither probably the people who'd taken those figures. But, I think that there's the whole thing around, it's a really difficult area when you start talking about restraints and whether people feel it's appropriate, not appropriate, the word physical intervention and so on. But whether it's about actually holding a child's arm to prevent them injuring themselves as they cross the road, or whether it's a restraint in the, to the extreme where children are violated.
I mean, that murkies the whole issue, doesn't it? Because I know that the issue of restraint is something that Ofsted, the fostering providers have to keep a record of that. That's part of their statutory duties. And then do you think there's a direct correlation between the restraint and the number of allegations of physical harm by children?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's undoubtedly an increase in the challenges that I think foster carers face with children that are coming into the care system. You know, there's always that debate, isn't there, about whether children have been left too long at home, maybe sometimes, and, that there's the resources, it's difficult to know whether there's resources, whether there's the sort of children in need and family support that's going in, whether that's enough. But I do know that what it feels like is that the day of, oh, we've got a child who needs a family, and they don't need much sort of therapeutic intervention, if you like, seems to be disappearing, and more agencies are going down the route of therapeutic parenting, because the children are coming in, pretty traumatised and with significant needs. And I think that without understanding that, and without carers receiving the right support and guidance around looking after children, then unfortunately people are human beings. And I think, I think what's happening is people are at the end of the tethers. We've just had a terrible year with COVID, and I don't know, are we yet to see the hidden harm around that? It's pretty much the unknown, I think, at the moment. But I think that it's about a duty of care to foster carers, so duty of care to children. And I think that we could safely say that most people don't go into fostering to harm children, and there's a system in place to educate people that do. But they come in with the best will in the world, and we do our best to prepare people for fostering and adoption. And SGOs and all the different things that are out there. But actually, when you're living in it 24 hours a day, I think it's very different.
Yeah. Mm. One of the things that I work in fostering, so it's my bread and butter. But I quite regularly do preparation to foster courses, that kind of getting people ready. And it's part of your statutory requirement. You have to do that before you go to panel. And one of the things that we're quite clear about is that there is a high likelihood of an allegation. But when you say allegation, does that include sort of concerns in relation to standards of care? Because we kind of make the difference where sometimes people are going, well, are they, it's not necessarily like, oh, the foster care has hit me, the foster care has done X. It's just general concerns. Is that reflected in some of the data that you've been looking at?
I don't think so. I mean, the standards of care for me are something sort of very different. And this this is ongoing, that sort of ongoing niggly stuff around actually whether it's good enough parenting, whether it's that there are, when you say standards of care, it's really difficult, isn't it? You've got, on one hand, you've got carers who are being asked to be compliant and carry out their role as a foster carer, to do recording and being available for training and support and so on. And then they've got the other role, which is actually to care for children and make sure that children have got the best and rich, most rich possibilities in their life. And that's making sure that they've got the right education, the right hobbies, the right interests, and you know, standards of care can be considered as, I don't know, carers maybe not providing the best that they can do for that child, and it could be really low level stuff. So I don't think it's actually included in those figures. It just talks about that the allegations were in the main physical abuse, and that there was allegations of sexual abuse was the least common, accounting for about 8%. So that's all it's sort of recorded in the guidance. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what happens to those allegations? Because I know that, I mean, this is, you know, the I think it was the GMB who put out, they said that something like one in four foster carers will experience an allegation. They talked about the nightmare of false allegations. So yeah. What is the outcome of those allegations? Where do they end up? Are they found to be substantiated or not?
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty is that, you know, that there's a process to follow, isn't there? I don't think you can prepare carers or anybody for what that's going to feel like ever, you know, and skills to foster and even doing training and all the right support. When that happens to a carer, I mean, it's pretty significant. And the worst thing that I believe can happen is the level of drift. Hence, I was putting some guidance out there, because I think that I understand there's a process to follow, but actually, if it's so the process basically is that when there's something being reported, that the person that takes the lead in that is the designated officer within the local authority, so the LADO, who look at professionals who abuse, and that there should be, you know, each local authority and agencies have got a very clear process for what that looks like. And about, you know, involving the police. Obviously, the police will only be interested if they feel there's a criminal offence to be answered. And they should be at the initial strategy meeting. And then following that, if there's no involvement for the police, then it's up to the local authority to do their investigation alongside maybe the independent agency and decide on you know, what's going to happen from there. But what's happening, I think, is that the good practice is stating that this should be looked at within 21 days, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that's not happening, and that I think that there was at least half of allegations that are going up beyond 21 days, and the impact that has on people's lives is horrendous. I was reading a very sad case. I can't remember the name of the guy, but he was, the drift in his allegation situation was so much so that he ended up ending his own life. And, you know, I think what it does to people when there is that lack of closure and that lack of commitment to support people through that process is, it's so significant. So, I mean, for me, the other thing is that I find really difficult is that there's sometimes it's too quick to move children, and I think that children make allegations for all different reasons. It might be legitimate. It might be that there's transference and that they're thinking about something from their past and that they've been settled enough to be able to do that. Or it might be that they feel, you know, that they've been disloyal to their family. They're struggling with that, having two families and being happy, maybe. There's lots and lots of reasons why children make allegations. And because of this process that we follow, even when there's a closure to it, most agencies and local authorities for good practice would take carers back to fostering panel. There's a deep report, and then people are getting to hear about that allegation and what happened, and you know, the whole process is really daunting.
So talking about drift then, I mean, it seems quite important that some of this stuff is dealt with within the timescales. So why is there such drift over something quite so important?
I think that that some of the drift sometimes comes from the police process, and I think that that initial strategy meeting takes place relatively quickly where everybody gets around the table, but then it's to just slow down in that there's different investigations going on, and you know, nobody should be interfering with that process. Of course it needs to happen, children need to be safe, and there is a process to follow, but there are the police might have their own priorities, the local authority, if they've decided to move a child, there might be less priority to actually move forward because the children have moved into a different environment. And from my experience, I've then just seen foster carers who are left without much information really about what's going on. And part of our guidance, you know, we really highlighted the importance of having a weekly, you know, catch-up meeting. Yes. that's telling people what's going on. They've got a right to know what's going on. And, you know, it's really clear within the National Minimum Standards that it actually says that concerns and allegations are dealt with fairly quickly and consistently in a way that provides effective protection for the child and at the same time supports the person who's subject to the allegation, you know. And sometimes I think we need to be reminded of that, you know, that these people's lives, and they can't foster whilst that's going on. It might be that they don't want to foster after that experience. And then we get situations where, we get referrals coming through where children have made lots of historic allegations.
Yeah.
They're a harder child to sometimes place because people are too nervous about taking them. And again, I say to agencies a lot, if you're upfront and you can talk about it and you can put a risk reduction plan in place, and we're not all jumping up and down immediately. Of course, if there's any real evidence of any harm, that needs to be dealt with. But that we deal with it risk sensibly, we're able to manage it as sensibly as possible. Then more carers might be willing to say, okay, you know, I'm willing to look at it, if we're not all going to jump up and down and make huge accusations.
I mean, I've been fostering social worker for about seven years now. And even in that short period of time, seen lots of different situations unfold. But one of the issues I've always sort of perceived is that potentially children, you know, as you said, children have experienced trauma, children who are under immeasurable pressure, and their perception of themselves and the world they live in has been impacted by that adversity and the nature of their lives. That then it becomes a really easy way for them to alleviate situations, to make an allegation. And they know that then that will means they're moved out of a situation that perhaps, where in a normal family that things get difficult, that's just not an option. And so it just creates this false, you know, the thresholds alter and family and children are moved, and which is catastrophic for children. Another move is just immeasurably harmful if it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, definitely. It really is. And I think that we've got to make sure that we're moving children for the right reasons. You know, it's really sad that we're, you know, these are children's lives. And I think that I do appreciate that there are times when that must happen and children must be protected. And there are situations where there has been clear evidence of harm. But, you know, we need to be looking at the types of training that we continue to offer carers, the support that we offer. We need to recognise fatigue and exhaustion in people, you know, and sometimes carers carry on with children because they don't want to give up on children, nor should they. And, you know, we need to try and help them through that. But there are times when, you know, when I used to be working in the environment, I'd recognise that somebody was, you know, they'd had it, they'd had enough. And sometimes we need to take that responsibility away from people and say, enough's enough, you know. And you can see the stress go from them when you've made that decision for them, because the last thing anyone wants to do is to let children down. It's heartbreaking that we're seeing more and more younger children who have had several placements moves, and they might be 10-year-old and have had seven moves in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, you know, we saw that in adolescents and teenagers. But I think we're seeing it much more in younger children who are quite traumatised, and carers are not equipped, or I think that under the illusion maybe at times that younger children are going to be easier to care for, which is not always the case.
Yeah. I mean, normally when we're having conversations like this, we would share personal experiences. All of my children made historical allegations against their foster carers, but I don't think it'd be fair on either my children, because that's their story, or the foster carers to share that. But it seems quite common. Mm. It seems quite common, maybe in placement, like in permanency placement I'm talking about, once they've moved on from foster care. I mean, is it a common thing, or is it restricted to the most
well-being? I mean, I don't think it's hugely common. And I think that, you know, I know that you've said you've had experience yourself. I think one of the things that maybe when I'm thinking about sort of things that we need to think about, especially with children who are with carers long term, is that we don't, you know, there's a balance between making it as, you know, as the word normal, but normal family life as possible for children to experience the same as any other children, whilst actually having a level of curiosity and caution, I would say. And, you know, and I think that what happens for me about long-term care sometimes is there's a complacency around safer caring. And yeah. I think, you know, we should never, ever be complacent, and we should never, ever, when a carer says that safer caring does not impact on them in their household, it worries me a little bit, you know. And I think we should always be, you know, thinking about it and making sure that we all respect boundaries, we all have that in place. And I think that when you take your guard down, we don't know how, you know, whether we're going to re-traumatise children and at any point by something that happens. So for me, safer caring is a huge thing for us to continue to consider, and there are ways to do it. We don't have to deny.
Can you, sorry to interrupt, but for people who don't necessarily know that terminology, because it's quite specific, isn't it? What do you mean? What do we mean when we talk about safer caring?
So when children are placed in foster care, we adopt something called the safer caring policy, and all carers have a safer caring policy that's their household safer caring policy. It's like the rules and the do's and don'ts. And then when children move in, it's more of a specific safer caring policy. So it's like, so how does this relate to the child that's in placement? Or how does this relate to this child if we have another child that's living there as well, or even the carer's own children? So it's about making sure that children are safe, other household members are safe as well. And that, you know, that doesn't have to seem as sort of damning as it is. I mean, that could seem quite stark, really, when you're talking about children living in family homes. But, you know, it could be just like really, you just sort of really low-key thinking around children playing safely in rooms, for example, and being observant of that. Things like, you know, if we know that a child's coming with significant risk, that we've safeguarded our own homes in some way. You know, just being a bit more mindful so that we sort of make sure that we can all be safe, really. Because there's nothing worse as well than, for me, I always talk about foster families as who have children are the most selfless young people ever, because they have to share their parents and their toys and their friends and everything. And they sometimes have to hear some pretty difficult stuff from kids who are angry and kids who are, you know, bad time. And it's no fun for them to hear their parent being called names or being attacked physically sometimes. And a natural thing for children who would hear that about their family might be to intervene. And it's, you know, it's there's a fine balance. And the last thing you ever, ever want is for a foster carer's own child to be accused of, you know, something, because it stays with you for the rest of your life if you, you know, if you go through that.
So, I mean, so sometimes it's really practical things like, for example, I would say don't, you know, you might with your children in your normal family life, your children might get into bed on a Saturday morning and you watch telly. Mm. And so on a practical level, you'd say, just don't do that. You know, it's not that we think there's any, you are dangerous, but it just removes that question mark, and it's staying as far away from an accusation as you possibly can, and keeping things, or knocking before you go into a room, or, you know, that sort of really practical stuff, isn't it?
And I think the thing about Skills to Foster training, when you're preparing people for the fostering journey, is that you talk about how much of that they could do prior to fostering, so that it's already in place. It feels like second nature to it, so that when children arrive, it doesn't feel different for them. And I know that from my own experience, when I used to run Skills to Foster, and we used to talk about the safeguarding side and allegations, pretty much in the middle of the Skills to Foster training, we could sense a lot of males within the room would be a little bit uncomfortable, because we'd be talking about not play fighting with kids, you know, rolling around floors and, you know, and doing some of that rough and tumble stuff might have to be considered, the stuff about, you know, and they would say, well, you know, that's what I do with my children. And when we talked about how that might seem for some children who've been abused, be, you know, that, so if you're going to lose people who can't adjust to that sort of life, then you pretty much lose them around the middle of that safer Skills to Foster training, really.
Because there's simple things, understanding with children's experience, you know, like me raising my voice, you know, children saying, oh, actually, you know, he was screaming in the house, which is a natural concern. If any professional gets told that, or Al was screaming in the house, I may not have been screaming, but that child's perception of a big hairy man like me raising his voice, it's a huge red flag for them. And it's kind of a beginning of a process that leads to some dark places. Yeah. Of course they're going to be freaked out. Of course they're going to say things. And of course they're going to maybe, that's going to then lead to that being an allegation of harm potentially.
Yeah, and I think we need to get better at a referral process and matching. You know, I think that, you know, it's hit and miss about, I've seen various quality of referral information that comes through about children.
Blimey.
I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, the more we know about a child's needs, the better match we can maybe offer. And the fact that a child's got, you know, quite a difficult history doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's not going to want to care for him, but it helps us prepare how we care for him. And, you know, we've got lots of skilled, fantastic foster carers out there that are, I mean, I'm in awe of people who choose to foster and, you know, people who've fostered for many, many years and have experienced allegations, and they've stuck with it, you know, and because it's really important that we share everything we know about children, we match the best we can, and then we continue to support and help carers. And if they are unfortunate enough to be in the position of allegations, then we need to make sure we've got the independent support that they need to help them understand the process and what that looks like. Because once carers hear that whole allegation, they might not hear much else. So it's important that someone to speak to them at another time to say, look, do you understand what's just been said? And let me talk that through with you. And then to be fair to them, it's really difficult, because then they've got to relive some of that through the whole panel process. And, you know, I'm always trying to talk to panels about, you're not there to reopen an investigation. You know, it's not your role to do that. That's been dealt with. There's closure to it, whether it's been unsubstantiated or you know, found or whatever it might be. But yeah, there's, you know, if there's a chronology or a history around allegations and it's from differing children and similar incidents over a long period of time, there might be something that needs to be looked at.
I mean, I think that generally, you described it in the Skills to Foster course, you know, the gents maybe being a little less kind of fascinated by the safe care stuff. But I mean, you know, they're not going to become foster carers if they don't come to terms with that and understand it and, you know, sign up to it. The allegations must be like one of the other things that people, when they start talking about that, they must be like, oh, can that happen? You know, because like you said, you know, people don't enter into this to abuse or neglect children. So it comes from somewhere, you know, that, you know, I'm sure there's some that slip through the net. Don't get me wrong. You know, we've seen, you know, around the world, foster carers and potentially adoptive parents who've slipped through the net in terms of, you know, their kind of intentions of doing that role. But do allegations also kind of increase people's kind of blood pressure when they start to hear about them, or is it kind of something that they just think, you know, they accept that would come?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think with the best will in the world, I think fostering agencies, local authorities, when they're delivering training and to carers, I think they try and do the best they can to talk through what that can be, you know, look like, and you know, and I think that carers, when they're going through that whole assessment process, which is, I mean, it's so intense, isn't it? It's so, you know, it has to be, you know, we can't apologise for that. It's got to be the right people who foster. Nobody's got a right to foster or adopt, but, you know, what a privilege to look after somebody else's children. But, you know, but actually I think they are that, you know, excited maybe about the whole prospect of the journey, that they don't take that part of it in, you know, at that particular point. And so that's why we've got to continue to be the eyes and ears as safe as we can. And you know, like I said before, we've got a duty of care to foster carers. Whether or not they have done something, we need to make sure that people can be as held as possible to get through that very difficult process where there are people investigating their lives, basically.
I'm finding it a very fascinating topic, but really difficult to talk about without kind of bringing other people's experiences into it. And I think the reason for that really is because, you know, when you think about allegations, you're right, you know, you don't go through listening to every single piece of information that's given to you when you're doing your preparation or your skills to foster. And I think that's hard then when it comes up. And like you say, you know, you only hear what, you know, if you're subject to an investigation, you only hear the first sections of that conversation, you know, and then the rest is kind of blocked out. I shared this a couple of weeks ago with Al, actually, when we had our older two children play, there were some very innocent remarks made to the foster carers when we were in the introduction phase. And I remember going into a meeting, we weren't told what it was about, going into the meeting, and all of this stuff kind of being said to us, and we had no clue. Allegations aren't really talked about in preparation to adopt, you know, they're more of a kind of fostering thing. So I guess it's all about awareness, isn't it? And about knowing that, you know, up until, I know that we're talking about fostering here, but, you know, up until the kind of adoption order is granted, you're really temporary foster care, looking after someone else's child, with the intention that they're going to be permanently placed with you to that point. So it's a very interesting subject, but very difficult, I find, to talk about as a.
Well, it's difficult as well for carers who you know may come out the other side of it. So a child's made an allegation, whatever that might be, that they've been hurt, or that they've been, somebody's, you know, said something to them, or whatever that might be. And then when children aren't moved, or the children retract and say that didn't happen, or it all seems a bit vague, or whatever, that, I don't know, I sometimes wonder if, you know, whether carers would look or feel differently about the child that they're with, and, you know, whether they, I mean, this sounds dreadful, but, you know, do you continue to like somebody in the same way that you might love them, but you might not like them the same way. Mm. And then, you know, a strain anyway on the relationship if a child is making ongoing allegations, you know, and I think there's got to be work around that, hasn't there? There's got to be work around helping children to. It was interesting. I had a conversation with somebody from an agency the other week, actually, who contacted me under NAFP because he knew I'd been doing this work around drifting allegations, and he talked to me about the difficulty that he had of a child who'd got learning disability, and actually was saying that the language that this child used was really difficult to get a true sense of what the child was saying, and that actually every time the child said something that everybody, the school just rushed off, you know, and went straight to the Lado situation, and there was no dialogue, and it all became alarm bells. And this child was going into to school, my understanding, quite often, and talking about things that, that his understanding of what was happening at home. And he would, you know, this agency was saying it's becoming really difficult to manage, because the good practice is that we, you know, we investigate it, of course we do. We close it down as an agency, we look at the learnings from it, what do we want to improve as an agency to be able to manage this. And that process involves, we'll take them back to panel. But they said that, you know, this is potentially that these carers are going to be back in panel several times a year. So we have to be sensible to that approach of what does that look like. So, you know, I've agreed to look at that as part of the allegation stuff I've been doing with NAFP about a sensible approach and obviously thresholds. And, you know, again, I'd never, ever want to step in the way of an investigation that must happen. But equally, it's about, you know, it's about understanding what's going on and a sensible approach that's actually safe for everyone, including that child, because the child's at risk of losing their fostering placement. I don't think that child wants to, you know, he's struggling, and thank God these carers haven't given up on him.
That reminds me of when I first qualified, I was working with a family and there was a little girl, and she was, I'll be honest with you, she was fantastic, and the care was really, you know, really good bond, really good match, and it was, everything was tickety-boo, apart from the child had this predisposition to tell absolute pork pies, or they would... And so there was a few incidents where things had escalated and different professionals had sort of had allegations set against them by this little girl. And then it sort of all came to a head one day when they'd gone to the dentist, and this little girl had come out of the dentist and said, you know, the dentist punched me in the face. And the carer said, well, I was there. There was no punching going on at all. And she sort of realised that it was when the carer had just sort of, the dentist just put his sort of finger, hand on his mouth, hand on her mouth, just to open it. And she'd reframed that as a punch. And there's not one professional who can't say, well, we need to look at that. And how do you do that in a way that is good? And, you know, you've got to get the bottom of that, but not in a way that kind of escalates every single incident to this high threshold where people are going to lose their careers. Really complicated.
And you do hear thresholds just in the fact that, you know, we've got this like, some of the larger local authorities, maybe that are firefighting, they've got just seeing thresholds within different local authorities is incredible. You know, the actual thresholds for bringing children into care, the thresholds for dealing with certain situations, it differs massively across the country. You know, I see that from members a lot, where there's, you know, one, if you ask the same local authority or the same agency, how might you deal with this situation? You're not going to have one consistent approach because there's different thresholds, there's different approaches. There's got, you know, you've got some social workers who are really like, you know, let's work this out, let's work in partnership team around the child. Yeah. There are others that it feels like cloak and dagger, where it feels like, you know, there's not that dialogue that's going on, and that people are working together to try and, you know, work it out really for the sake of the children.
Yeah, that's remarkable. As we were talking, I realised that as a foster carer, we'd had an allegation against us, sort of wiped it from our memory due to the trauma. But it was an allegation by a family member saying that there was a physical mark on one of the children when they'd gone to contact. And I remember the visceral feeling of sort of two social workers appear. Oh, hello, what are you doing here? And they sit in your front room, and they, like, a bit like you, Scott, where they go, you're kind of like a bit, yeah, you're trying to make sense of why is this happening? You know, what are they saying? And they're saying, there's been this allegation, and they went through the process. I mean, fortunately, they did it really quickly. But I remember, you know, my wife, Paula, she just was beyond herself. She just, the thought that she, you know, she was racking her brain. It was sort of unfounded. There was no substance to it. And it was, you know, ultimately, it was kind of thought to be malicious. But is there an element of, do we know anything about that? Because sometimes families who've got children in foster care are feeling immeasurably disempowered, aggrieved, and often foster carers are sort of in the line of sight for that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, it's interesting because I think when COVID, I'll be struck. Everybody had to start doing things very differently. And that included family time, contact. And I think that what we thought would happen would we'd see a massive amount of children who was completely unsettled during COVID. And I think that the early evidence came out that we saw the opposite of that, where it were almost like they was in this therapeutic bubble with their carers, and that all the external sort of problems that are out there, such as maybe school and the influence and bullying and family time and the whole anxiety that can bring, as much as they want to see their family, families sometimes unfortunately don't turn up, or it hasn't gone very well and children's behaviours change as a result of that sometimes, or, children struggle with that whole, when the family turn up and they don't want to talk in a way about their foster carers in a positive light because that doesn't look great, or, I think what we saw in COVID maybe was reduction in some of that type of, maybe, I don't know, that'd be an interesting thing to look at around allegations of from parents, if you like, during COVID, when they were virtually and they were on Zoom and so on. Whereas, I've seen carers where they're frightened to death that parents might be scrutinising their what they're wearing and their bodies, and they find a mark and they go, this wasn't there before. And I get it. I think that they're fighting for their lives, and that it must be devastating for your children. It's the most terrible thing. And no matter what we have to remind foster carers to remain respectful of that and professional, and not to personalise things, because actually this is somebody who's desperately hurting. It's not a personal slant against the foster carers. It would be anybody who would be caring for their children.
Yeah.
And then the opposite of that, don't you, where you have carers and families who, get too friendly, and then actually they become almost friends, and then something goes on and there's an allegation that flies in on that, and the carers are absolutely gobsmacked because they thought that everything was great between them. So again, you've got to think about the professionals and our role within supporting. It's that whole, what you mentioned earlier about that reduction and almost working in a proactive way to prevent allegations. Have we got everything right, to be able to reduce the thought that there might be some allegations, and there's always going to be things out of the blue where we just can't believe it's happened. But actually, when we do, I do reflective case reviews, and we look at serious case reviews, then we actually have to look at, did we do everything we could do as professionals working in the sector to reduce the impact, really.
So
in terms of, well, when all said and done, what are some of the top recommendations out of all this from you?
Well, I mean, obviously, when thinking about allegations, for me, it's about let's do what the national standards talk about and deal with things fairly, quickly and consistently, and in a way that people held and keeps people, so that they're informed, that we're transparent as much as we can be, and that we keep the trust and respect from people who have to face this and get it dealt with as quickly as possible. And sometimes there might be reasons that can't be, and it needs to be longer and it needs to be dealt with. But where there's no strong evidence, let's move along. Let's not use our resources as a reason to delay, or, that we haven't got the time to be able to do it. We've got people who need for this to be resolved as quickly as possible. So in the guidance that we produced, it's about, let's try and look towards a 21-day process. Let's be, let's be really clear on the process, and let's get it dealt with as much as possible, and learn from things, learn as agencies how we can put in, revisit our policies, procedures, our training, our learning and development, recognise when carers need a break, look at the respite, look at the value of, social events, look at the value of actually being connected and noticing when we think that things are a little bit different for children and for carers and their families.
So really, it's like, I mean, this is quite basic stuff, isn't it? That actually we just need to refocus on and get it right rather than, you know, I think the drift thing is really, that's kind of taken my breath away a little bit because, you know, it just, you know, to think that people are going through that, whether it's, I found it, you know, a kind of allegation that's right or wrong, you know, if things are drifting and like you said, you know, someone taking their own life as a result of that, that's just, you know, we shouldn't be, well, I say we, I'm not a social worker or anything to do with a foster agent, but you know, that's just not right.
Do you think it's that people are sort of saying, oh, well, we've moved the children are fine, and that stuff will just work itself out? The allegation,
I hope that's not the case, but to be honest with you, it is, you know, when you're dealing with several cases that are in the court arena and you're looking at safeguarding, and you know that you've got children who are safe somewhere, then, you know, which are you going to deal with? You know, I'm not saying that's going on. The LADOs are there to be able to move that along about professional who abuse and look at some level of closures. And the agency, what I'm suggesting in our guidance is that if you're an independent agency, you maybe try and look towards, if there's no reason for any further drift, like the police aren't involved and so on, and that they've been able to interview people, that they ask that the local authority and the independent agency work together to get it closed down, to get it back into fostering panel, if that's their process, in a timely way that means that, you know, there is less harm.
Recording stopped.
Yeah.
Question then, to another question to ask you, and this is sort of like a Scott's sort of rounding it up and I'm opening it up, which is really terrible. is the question, is there a case where do we see a correlation between drift between specific agencies? Do we see that the local authorities are better at this, or the, you know, the independent foster care agencies are better at this? Or is there just no correlation? Is it just totally random?
Well, because allegations they have to be dealt with through the process through the local authority with the LADO process. It's like, I think sometimes the independent sector feel a bit in limbo, like they're waiting for things to progress so that they can do their bit of it. They can, you know, because obviously if an allegation comes in, the very first thing that must happen is that the LADO's informed, Ofsted are informed and kept informed periodically around the progress of that. And I mean, obviously Ofsted monitor allegations and look at the time span for those being dealt with and look at the escalation policy that agencies have got about getting things dealt with as quickly as possible. But I just think it's as simple as getting together and, you know, and having those regular communications about, so that everyone knows what's going on and everybody can communicate the same thing.
Cool. That has been fascinating, hasn't it, Scott?
Yeah, it has. I mean, it genuinely has, because I think that, some of it's shocked me. Like I said, it's a really difficult thing to talk about. So thank you so much for coming on, Kelly. I know it's like your bread and butter at the minute, but for us, that's quite, well, for me, it's quite a new thing to listen to and to hear kind of some of the issues and stuff. So thank you so much for sharing and giving us something to think about, I think.
And can people read the research anywhere? Is there, your recommendations, are they published anywhere or?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've got the drift guidance for anyone who's a member of NAFP that we produced. But there's, yeah, I can certainly, I mean, off the top of my head, I haven't got the information, but let's have a look.
Well, if you get them to us, we'll put them in the link to the, and people can find them.
Yeah, definitely. I'll share that with you, and then you
That's
can.
That's great.
You can share that, yeah. And I'm running allegations training as well. So the plug.
Hey, boy. Nice one.
Okay, fostering services, you know. So I'm just trying to help people learn how to deal with it as quickly as possible and respectfully.
Excellent. We'll put that link in as well. Give us a link, we'll put it in. That's not a problem. We don't care. We'll sell anything, won't we? Well, Catherine, thank you so much for your time and energy, and I hope you have a fantastic week, and we'll hopefully speak to you in the future sometime.
Yeah, it'd be a pleasure to come back on. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you, Catherine.
Bye-bye.
Bye.